Hello, I'm John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. Welcome to this week's Companies and Markets podcast. I'm joined today by Mark Robinson. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm okay, John.
Good. Ian Smith, how are you doing, Ian?
Fine, thanks, John.
You've been looking after the news this week.
I sure have.
First time?
Yes.
Yeah, excellent. How'd it go?
Yeah, I think it went fine. You sell me.
Yeah, it was all right.
Okay.
And over in the control room, multitasking, Julia Bradshaw.
Hi, John.
How are you doing?
Good.
Good. And you're going to be talking to us later about your cover feature this week, which
I am.
Supermarkets.
Indeed.
And whether it's time to buy again. But let's come on to that in a minute. But the real big story this week is oil and BG and its bid by Shell.
We're awash with oil.
That has been the problem, obviously, recently. But let's kick off, Ian, with your first roundup of the investment world at large. 7 days. What's been going on this week?
I mean, a couple of positive trends, really, this week. I mean, European M&A activity has really been leading it. You mentioned the Shell BG deal. We also had the FedEx deal for TNT.
You'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, forgotten about that. Somewhat overshadowed. But yeah, a tale of two deals, I think, is how I characterise kind of the company's news this week. And I think that it kind of that feeds into a wider theme around really just a positive Europe story. We had Mark here wrote a news piece about how Europeans' main benchmark indices had done really well in the first quarter. And I think this kind of positive European story, US companies looking to buy into Europe, has really been one of the dominating stories this week. We've also had some positive economic forecast data from Italy upgrading its economic forecast. So, you know, kind of more of a positive Eurozone story there.
Greece made the nut with the IMF as well.
Exactly. Greece, we've just found out that that payment has been made of €450 million, that loan repayment, which there were some kind of question marks over, that has been paid. So yeah, a little bit of good news, I'd say.
Excellent. Well, I mean, Europe. How much of that is QE driving share prices upwards? I mean, the DAX has been flying.
Yeah, well, more to the point, what it's done to the euro. Prospects for European exporters like Germany.
Driving down the price of the euro the vis-a-vis other currencies.
Well, that's right.
Has really lifted the prospects for European exporters.
Yeah, certainly, without a doubt. I mean, and conversely, it's worked against prospects for emerging market economies as well. The same thing happened when we had QE in the US. We were following the same sort of experience there. How long the ECB, I mean, we're talking about a trillion euro expansion of the balance sheet in Europe, but how long the ECB is going to keep this going is anyone's guess. I mean, they may be slightly less inclined to sort of nip it in the bud now that Germany and other economies in Europe seem to be doing quite well on the back of it.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on in.
No, I was just going to say, and just to feed into that as well, in Italy, kind of the slump in the oil price has kept energy costs low for companies, which they think is a good driver of kind of perhaps Italy to emerge from recession.
Well, you talked about this a while back, the economic benefits of a low oil price.
Yeah.
And there was some scepticism that this would actually happen. But
well, it takes some time as well. You don't get the benefits flowing through immediately, but now we're seven, 8 months into sort of a relatively low oil price period, so we should start to see some material benefits coming through to these economies.
I also note on the numbers this week, which I don't know who put that together. Did you put that together?
I put that together.
Ian put that together.
I like this. European real estate seems to be on the up. It's commercial real estate.
It's a surprisingly big figure there,
isn't
it? 7.8% price growth from the third quarter to the fourth quarter last year in European commercial real estate.
One can only assume that that's a knock-on effect of improved business confidence there.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what's feeding into the figure there. But
well,
yeah,
it's just coming from a fairly low base as well. Don't forget, for most of those markets, I think
growth is growth.
Growth is growth.
If you're buying it now, then you know you're at the beginning of potentially a huge uptrend, I guess.
I think at the early part of next month we'll be covering this in a feature as well, giving readers the rundown on which European property markets offer the best prospects at the moment.
I think we're talking residential there, aren't we?
We're talking residential in that case, yeah.
Okay. Time to buy a Spanish villa again.
Well, we'll have to wait for Jonas Crossland on that point.
Okay. Yeah, so the other, I mean, you know, we're going to talk about oil in more detail in relation to the BG Shell deal in a minute. But, Ian, it's a subject that I know is dear to your heart, Iran. And things there, which are obviously massively important in terms of global geopolitics and actual oil too, the political situation there is thawing from the looks of things.
It seems to be. It's hard to tell with these things because obviously in both the US and in Iran, the people that have struck the deal have now got to go and sell the deal to their respective hardliners. But yeah, it seems to be another positive factor for the global economy that there's been this kind of tentative accord reached. Obviously, Israel, as a key ally of the US in the region, is kind of steadfast against the deal in its current form. So there may yet be some more politicking around it. And, you know, the sanctions won't be lifted tomorrow, but it's potentially positive. And I think initially had an upward impact on oil stocks, so they might be able to say more about that.
Yeah, I mean, there was the oil price dipped towards the end of last week on good news with regard to the accord. But as you mentioned, this deal, even if it is brokered, may take 12 months or more to actually come to fruition. So traders were more influenced actually by news coming out of the US that production there had dipped for the first time in living memory, really, in March. There's a theory out now that the unconventional sources in America may well have peaked, which will over time rebalance the oil market. And so oil prices rose on the back of that.
Yeah, because we talked about this. So, shale oil has been obviously the big destabilizing factor in terms of the oil price decline over the past few months.
And the period of low oil prices now has forced sort of a lower margin plays out of the US. The levels now are approaching the 1970s peaks for the United States, so it is still incredible the amount of oil that's been produced over the last 3 or 4 years. And there was also worries linked to stockpiles in the States. Part of that was due to an increased rate of import from outside the US as well. The net result, though, is that oil prices started to recover somewhat. And, you know, the question now is, has the US reached an inflection point in production?
Okay, but you told me also that a number of hedge funds are betting on a rising oil price now.
Yeah, they are. They are looking ahead. I mean, not sort of massively rising, but everyone's looking at about $65 a barrel in terms of Brent crude.
But the point is, we don't feel it's likely that there will be significant weakness in the months ahead.
No, not compared to what we have seen, no.
Okay, well, that's
despite the discovery of a load below Sussex.
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, the UK could throw a spanner in the works there. I mean, that's an announcement that just came out today. Various companies have interest in this this complex down in the Weald. Sort of,
it's covers, huge.
It is huge at the moment. I mean, the numbers they're giving, that 158 million barrels of oil per square mile on the license, which covered 55 square miles, that equates to something just under 9 billion barrels of oil. It's enormous. But, I mean, of course, what percentage of that is recoverable is unknowable at this stage. And it will be down to unconventional drilling, fracturing. But the company itself, UK Oil and Gas Investments, they're up by over 200% at one point today.
What was the price at the start of the day?
Oh, I can't remember the
pennies.
Price. Was it? Yeah, well, it was. It was, you know, I don't want any sort of letters in from readers saying, "Why didn't you identify this?" But you know,
I'm sure they will arrive.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting story, but we wouldn't know if this will have any legs for months yet. They have to have an appraisal, and it's a great little story. But I mean, what it means over the long term, we can't really sort of comment on that yet.
Okay. Okay, so yeah, the big oil story though, of course, this week is BG.
Yes.
So let's talk BG.
Let's talk BG anyway. The one thing that's come out, I've read a number of notes that have come out this morning, and people are actually saying, oh God, they've paid well over the odds for BG assets, and in the same time we've got notes saying, oh, this is a bargain.
Yeah.
A bargain. It just shows you how ludicrous the whole thing is.
So let's talk about the details. So Shell is buying BG. Outright, and it's an agreed deal.
An agreed deal recommended by BG's board for a total of around about £47 billion.
Then I saw another figure saying £55 billion, but God knows what that is. Maybe includes the dividend, who knows?
Perhaps. It values BG at £13.50 a share.
Nice.
It's sort of cash share deals. I think off the top of my head, I think it was about 353p, and then the rest in scrip. Something of a surprise at the time, I guess. I mean, BG.
Well, we tipped this, didn't we?
We had BG
3 weeks ago.
Yeah, I know we had BG, but
you're feeling very smug, state, are you, Robert?
Not at all. Not at all. No, it's purely coincidental because I mean I have to. I mean I've been dealing with a dross over the last 6 months in the oil market, so I mean it was a welcome relief, to be honest. But it's an interesting deal, if for no other reason then, you know, is this the initiation point for some other large-scale deals in the industry? I guess the main reason, or there's many reasons why Shell have brought BG in the books, but the main one, as far as I can tell, is that it takes them to the front-running position in the global LNG market. Yeah. They were very strong in that anyway, but obviously... BG was a particularly attractive part of their business.
So there was a particular asset that comes with this deal, which is the big LNG facility they've just built in Queensland.
Well, no, it's up and running now. It's up and running. So yeah, they've the first sort of seaborne exports at the tail end of last year, and I think they've had a second load going out.
It's a $20 billion facility.
It's enormous. It's absolutely enormous, and you know, given its proximity to Asian markets as well, I mean, it's very attractive. Shell have actually got assets in Queensland and the Bowen Basin as well, slightly different ones, but you know, there's obviously tremendous cost synergies in prospect.
Because I think you said to me yesterday that a lot of their assets sit next to one another.
Yeah. You know, throughout the globe, I mean, it's hardly surprising. Shell's everywhere, but you know, there are a number. Some mega deals you get like this, and you think to yourself, given history, you think, oh my God, it's going to be a disaster. They tend to destroy value.
Yes, absolutely.
But looking at this, at least initially, you would think that this makes a lot of strategic sense.
It looks like a good one to me.
Yeah,
it does. I mean, as I said, you know, interest, full disclosure, my wife owns a number of shares in BG that she inherited actually a result of the spin-outs from British Gas from the privatisation many, many, many years ago.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we stand to get a bit of cash back from that, and we stand to get some shares in Shell.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, great. Those shares in Shell are wonderful. Dividend-paying shares. And let's talk about the dividend because, you know, does this impinge upon their ability to keep paying that at the level it's at now?
Well, they've got a deal here which is an effective 50% premium to the current share price at the moment.
Yeah, but which is still below its peak.
Yeah, well below, you know,
prior
its peak.
To a couple of years back.
And it's not a huge cash element there, but you know, Shell's cover wasn't great in terms of their dividend yield, but they've got a sort of an unparalleled record in sort of maintaining and then increasing their dividend. There's still a very good yield at the moment, but obviously the anxiety is, given all this, will be they able to sort of back their dividend over the next couple of years, given oil prices are fairly drab at the moment. We tend to think that,
but potentially going higher if the hedges
potentially,
hedges
yeah.
To be
I think it probably will go higher, and plus the fact that Shell are on the deal now, some of BG's underperforming assets in Egypt and Brazil. There's already been movement in Brazil because what was happening down there with the state probe into
Petrobras.
Yeah, there was a chance that BG's operations down there were to be slowed. You know, they were going to get trouble getting the infrastructure in place, the floating platforms. But with Shell behind them, apparently there's already been movement on that. So that's obviously a positive for them. They've started to get the backdated payments through from Egypt, BG.
Was this the stuff that was the force majeure?
Yeah, that's it was clear because, I mean, the Egyptian authorities just diverted gas supplies to the domestic market rather than the export market just to make sure they didn't have a revolution, you know, keep the air conditioners running. I mean, our readers will remember, you know, BG, it was a bit like Rent-A-Kill Initial for years. It just couldn't do anything wrong whatsoever.
Yeah,
you know, improvement
yeah.
year after year. And suddenly when they got problems, then there was just a storm of problems.
Yeah, well, companies don't exist problem-free forever.
Yeah, but, well,
so, I think it's exciting. I think, you know, the combination, it could take Shell to new heights.
But are there any competition issues over the deal, particularly in the LNG market?
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely go through the process. But
it's
going
to take a year, isn't it? It's 2016.
Yeah, definitely. Hedgelund is going to stay on for a year and get a golden parachute.
Was he brought in to make this happen?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, this
it's only been there 5 minutes.
Well, exactly. I mean, presumably they just didn't work out the deal on the back of an envelope over the weekend.
Indeed.
So,
having said that, I've read some reports. It didn't take many of them to agree this deal over the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, and there you go. I mean, I think oil companies are obviously looking at these sort of things all the time, doing the numbers all the time. So, you know, BG just seemed to be a good fit for Shell.
All right. So let's talk about. So there has been a lot of talk that this marks a point at which the industry consolidation in oil and gas begins in earnest. Because, I mean, you know, the reality is that these deals don't happen when an industry is strong because, you know, assets aren't cheap. There's no value to be had. Yeah. And there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, who's next. And actually, if you look at the risers and fallers column this week on the 7 Days page, you know, Premier Oil, SoCo, Hunting. Another tip this week.
It's another tip this week. I mean, we've been...
it's unfortunate.
Unfortunately, in between the time I initiated the tip and to when it's going to go to publication, there was a significant rise in the share price.
Yeah, what a shame. But it still represents good value because it's
a great company.
But the point is that, you know, the oil industry has been hammered.
Yeah.
But there are some wonderful companies out there.
Yeah, without a doubt.
And oil demand and gas demand, and we talked about this recently, gas demand in particular is not going away.
Well, this is the main thrust for the BG deal is because of the gas assets and the fact that, you know, Shell wants to get at the apex of the market which provides the best long-term fundamentals in energy.
And gas is becoming an increasingly important source of electricity generation, power generation.
It seems little doubt by the end of this year that gas prices, and gas pricing is a separate subject, very complex, but by the end of the
year... Almost impossible to understand.
But by the end of this year, it's likely that gas prices will sort of, not necessarily tank, but they will fall significantly because of new production coming onto the market.
But long-term?
You've got to take a long-term view, and in that case, it's not the only game in town, but it's the one you want to be following.
So, take Japan as an example. I mean, there was a very large nuclear generating capacity there.
Yeah.
That's gone.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there was a one-off. Obviously, the Fukushima was a one-off issue in Japan.
But it's changed the way they view energy generation.
I think they may have got one reactor back on now, and they will get others.
But Germany has basically pulled away from nuclear as well.
Totally. One of the main points is that the demand is coming through Asia, and China is turning away from coal. I mean, obviously, air problem is turned into a sort of fundamental issue for the economy now, not just one for the populace itself. So they're building more gas-fired power stations. The same in India. I mean, the same in this country as well, and throughout Europe. It's going to be the sort of main generator of electricity for the next 30-40 years.
No, it's amazing. I've read a piece you wrote, one of the results you wrote this week as well, Ithaca. So I mean, there's a lot of small. There's some good assets out there, but at the smaller end, which has been kind of heavily sold off.
The A-band,
you know, there were some good assets that have been sold off heavily there. And Ithaca, I know it notably cheap. Really?
Yeah, I mean, it's been so depressing covering these companies in recent months. It really has, because you've had companies there that are actually well managed, great assets, but you know, like any sort of commodity backed stocks. I mean, you know, you're trying to analyze top up or top down and then bottom up.
Yeah.
You know, it's very difficult to do. But, you know, Ithaca, to me, you know, it would be a prime candidate for a takeover there as well.
But then, of course, on the same page, you've got Kaza, which is not so good.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think you've got to still be selective. You know, the oil recovery, if indeed there is one, is not going to lift all boats
People are absolutely, investors have just shunned the North Sea over the last 6-8 months anyway.
So. Yeah. No, it's fascinating. And actually, I mean, talking about demand for oil, I mean, Ian, there's a story in 7 Days here. Car sales in the UK have been absolutely flying.
Yeah, and also because people just like new number plates with 15 on them, which is really the key driver, pardon the pun. Car sales continue to be really strong in the UK, which is providing great strength to some of the alternative lenders. And I mentioned S&U here. We saw that in results season, some of the lenders with exposure to the motor finance market really benefiting from that. Just a strong story in it. And it's taken as a real strong indicator of UK economic recovery in the car market.
Yeah. God, it's good news for the Tories going into the election, isn't it?
Yeah, it's well timed.
Very well timed indeed. Let's talk supermarkets, Julia. So supermarkets is the cover feature.
It is, indeed.
But subsequent to writing that, obviously we had the latest Kantar.
Figures from Kantar, yes. The grocery market share figures which came out, which are actually a continuation of the theme we've been seeing over the past year, really.
So what are we seeing? So who's doing well, who's not doing so well?
So what we're seeing is the discounters, Aldi and Lidl, doing very well, increasing market share, increasing their sales by double digits.
Which is terrible news for UK investors because you can't buy those companies on the UK market.
Privately owned, family-owned companies, continental companies. And meanwhile, you've got the likes of Morrisons, Tesco and Sainsbury's struggling, really. And it really is a sandwich effect, which was sort of symbolised over the Easter holiday when I was with my family and I spoke to a good family friend, very sort of middle-class, affluent woman. And I asked her where she shopped, and she said, oh, she shops at Aldi now. And she does all her shopping at Aldi, and what she can't find in Aldi, she goes to Waitrose. So you've got Aldi and Lidl on the one hand at the very bottom, and then you've got Waitrose and the likes of M&S Food at the top, squeezing, sandwiching the supermarkets. And that's what's happening. And that's all against a backdrop of deflation, lower prices, falling prices, and this sort of supermarket price war. So it's been pretty bad news for the supermarkets.
So I've had an interesting week with the supermarkets. So we've just moved house, as I've probably told you a million times before. But since I moved house, I've been doing all my shopping in Marks and Spencers. I mean, that's, you know, what has happened to me. What has happened to me? Although they don't sell corn.
Really?
I had to go next door to Iceland to buy my corn.
Well, M&S is quite traditional, and I'm corn's a bit too hippie for them.
Yeah, yeah. Good God, Iceland.
You must be feeling pretty plush, John. M&S is not cheap for food.
I don't think that's true.
Buying a new car, buying a new house, moving up in the world.
Oh, he's doing well.
Oh, yeah. Don't give me that. I don't think M&S is actually that expensive. It's the same as Waitrose. The perception is that Waitrose is an expensive supermarket. That's not actually the case. And I think you mentioned this in the feature you've written, the excellent feature.
Yes, thank you very much.
This week, is that actually in many so Waitrose funds some of its cheaper lines with some of its much more expensive stuff.
Yeah, Waitrose has a very clever business model in that it has lovely stores, very helpful staff who actually own part of the company as well.
Always good. We like that.
Yeah, we do like that. And they have this very clever combination of expensive sort of exclusive products on the one hand and a basics range, which is actually the same price as Sainsbury's and Tesco to some extent. And you get people pushing their trolleys down the aisle, they're picking up the basic stuff, and then, maybe they see some sort of fine Greek extra virgin olive oil that they buy for £8 for half a litre. And that subsidises the cheaper products, and it's a very clever business strategy for Waitrose, and that's why they've been so successful.
Do you think they'll get a little bit more? I mean, you know, now they've been overtaken by discounts. Do you think Waitrose will get a bit more aggressive?
Yeah, I think Waitrose will certainly expand, and Little Waitrose, their convenience stores are certainly going to expand as well. I mean, what scope Waitrose has to cut prices and actually compete with the likes of Aldi and Lidl, I'm not too sure.
It's a different game, though, isn't
it? It's a completely different market they're after. You know, they're not looking at sort of mass bulk sort of selling of flogging products. Waitrose is all about the experience.
Yeah, I've got to say, they've opened a little Waitrose up next to Cannon Street Station, and I pop in there in the morning to get my croissant, and it's so cheap. It's cheap.
Yeah, it's
cheaper
not as
than
expensive
canteen
as
here.
People think.
Do you hear that, canteen? I hope you're listening.
There's even a line in that Waitrose for people picking up their morning coffee.
It's indeed.
Which is interesting, kind of almost like a coffee shop.
It's extraordinary.
And you can pick up your purchase from John Lewis as well.
I think it is rather good. So the point, I guess, is where does this leave the supermarkets that we can invest in?
Indeed. I mean, the point is that the supermarkets have had a pretty rubbish year, it's fair to say. The share price has just plummeted. And now, from January on, there has been sort of signs that the sector is recovering and that we might be in for a massive recovery play.
Because the share price have picked up a bit.
Tesco's share price is up 20% since the start of the year, so at least 20%.
Dangerous Dave. Dangerous Dave? Drastic Dave Lewis. Dangerous Dave. Drastic Dave.
And they all have new management teams, new plans, new strategies, cutting prices, cutting CapEx, cutting the dividend as well.
So that's not so good, because I mean, this was always a sector that everybody liked for its income attractions.
Exactly. What people liked about the supermarkets were that they symbolise sort of a secure, steady bet. You know, supermarkets won't go down. They'll
just
keep
like the
plodding
banks.
Along.
Just like the banks used to.
Meanwhile, you benefit from this 5% yield. And now, I mean, who knows where those yields are going to be? No one really knows how far the dividends are going to be cut. And indeed, no one really knows what the margins are going to look like, where the margins will settle.
We do know that Morrison's dividend will be not less than 5p a share.
Right.
That's
about it.
Yeah.
And so I suppose the big conclusion we came to was that, yes, there are potentially green shoots here and there could be a recovery, but it is still very early days and that you still must tread with caution here. Because Tesco, for instance, these accounting discrepancies that they had a few months ago, it might not be the end there. And if that comes back to bite Tesco, then we could see sort of a wobble in the share price. And as I said before, yes, sales are improving, volumes maybe are improving, but one quarter really of less bad or one quarter of an improved decline in sales doesn't necessarily say that, oh, this is a trend that will continue. I mean, it could have just been an anomaly.
I mean, there's a lot of talk of deflation generally, but in terms of food price inflation,
I think they were down 2% at the last count.
Even more than that, I think it was close to 3 or 4 even. I mean, it's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. And I've noticed my weekly shop has gone down.
I haven't noticed mine has, but then I've just moved to shopping at Marks & Spencer.
Well, that's probably why.
Maybe that's it. So, you know, in light of all of this, in light of the food price inflation we're seeing, the rising competition from discounters, and also non-discounters who are, you know, the higher end, who are incredibly popular amongst the more affluent sections of society, you know, where does this leave the middle ground? What are our views on Sainsbury's, Tesco, Morrison? I mean, you know, should we be buying these shares in anticipation of further recovery?
I wouldn't buy the shares at this point
any
in time. Any of them. I think we have all three on a hold, actually. Until fairly recently, we had Tesco and Morrison's on a sell.
Yep.
We moved those to hold. We've had Sainsbury's on a hold, pretty much. In terms of the individual supermarkets, Sainsbury's, we like. It's well run. It's a profitable business. I think it'll continue to plod along. So we have a whole recommendation on those shares. Tesco, you know, I like what Dave Lewis is doing. And I do think there's scope for Tesco will recover. Tesco is a massive company and it will recover. And the supermarkets aren't going away. They are here to stay.
You talk about Tesco in terms of being perhaps a bit bloated in terms of its globally. I mean, Tesco was becoming a massive
global business. It was becoming
way
too big.
And it's going to retrench. Yeah.
Well, it has over the past couple of years actually retrenched. It's sold off its US business. It's gone into a joint venture with its China business. It is slowly slimming down. And it has scope to do that. It has scope to sell off a lot of its peripheral businesses. Remember, it owns Harrison Hull coffee shops, Blinkbox.
Is it Blinks? Blinkbox, you sold Blinkbox.
It has sold that.
I think it sold that already. Tool Talk, yeah.
Yeah. Dunnhumby, they were thinking of selling
That's the customer data business that powers Clubcard.
Yep.
That would be
valuable data.
Valuable, but isn't that what's helped them become so strong in the first place?
It has.
Hmm.
And it can sell off Giraffe as well. It owns Giraffe restaurants.
It hasn't owned that for very long.
No, not that long.
Hmm.
Anyway, the point is there is scope for Tesco to slim down.
Okay.
And there is scope for Dave Lewis to cut prices and improve the store experience and basically get shoppers to come back and do their weekly shop there because the prices are good. Again, Tesco will perceive to be good value and the shopping experience might be slightly nicer than it might be at a place like Aldi and Lidl.
I still think it's got a long way to go on that.
It's got a long way to go, but it will recover.
Yeah.
It will recover.
All right. Morrison.
Morrison's, however, we have Morrison's on a hold.
Generous, I would say.
We're still not completely convinced about the Morrison story. Arguably, Morrison's is the most susceptible to Aldi and Lidl because the sort of demographic that tends to go to Morrison's is less affluent, perhaps, than Sainsbury's or even Tesco. And, you know, Morrison's has just gotten everything wrong that it could. It's been late to online. It's been late to convenience. The former chief executive, Dalton Phillips, stepped down. And when I spoke to the chairman a few weeks ago, he gave the distinct impression that basically the new chief executive and himself had been handed a mess. Without so much saying so. So I think there are bad times to come for Morrison's, and I think it will be an uphill battle.
Yeah.
Whether or not it'll disappear.
Well, it's going to be shutting a lot of the convenience stores that it's only just opened.
Exactly. It's going to be shutting them, and it's going to be reassessing the whole convenience store rollout and where they're going to put convenience, whether or not they should, you know, be opening convenience stores. The fact that they have to reassess this convenience offer just months after they've started rolling, or maybe a year after they started rolling stores out, is pretty shocking. It suggests that Dalton Phillips had no idea what he was doing.
Yeah, but he wasn't actually going out and choosing the sites. You know, he wasn't actually going out and choosing the sites.
No, but
upon
he was in charge.
He was in charge. But, I mean, there's a couple over near me. They are, they're not doing too well. Visually, not doing too well.
No.
And they don't appear to have actually been needed by the community that they're servicing either. Stephen and I talked about this a couple of weeks back, but anyway, yeah, Morrison's. We kind of agreed then that we would have had enough Morrison kicking for a while.
Morrison's still a mess.
Yeah.
Sainsbury's stable, Tesco the potential recovery play, but exercise caution here.
Okay, but what about Marks and Spencer? Because they've been flying this week.
They have, yeah. M&S has been doing surprisingly well, actually. I mean, not hugely well. There is a slight improvement in general merchandise sales.
Yeah, but that's after a long period of regular declines.
I think it was something like 16 quarters of like-for-like declines. So that is a good...
But you've changed your view.
I changed him to a hold, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So. Wow, I mean, that's big news.
I know you don't like M&S.
Well, neither of us do.
John.
I've got to say, I'm a convert to the food. I love it.
Well, I have to disagree with you there. I think it's overpriced for what it is. But the food, actually, interestingly, the food division held up reasonably well, but it didn't grow as fast as it has been growing previously at M&S. Oh. So that was an interesting piece of information.
Well, maybe I'm a contrary indicator. I'm liking it. Oh, anyway, thank you, Judy.
Enough of these grocers, John. What else is in the magazine?
What else in the magazine? There's lots in the magazine this week. We have updated, Chris Dillo has updated the No Thoughts portfolios,
mm-hmm.
Which are basically mechanical portfolios that we've run for a very long time. And it's Momentum that's delivering there again. Momentum is a strategy that it's just extraordinary, really.
Interesting new spotlight this week was Alex Newman's taking a look at
short
positions through the institutions. Worth a look.
Like his headline.
Mm-hmm.
Like his headline. Big shortlist. Who's getting the brunt of that? Green King, I noticed, was the one of the most shorted companies in the UK.
Yes. It's just to do with general trends as well. But I mean, he looks at the sectors here too. So I mean, it's really worth.
I think that's funny because, you know, we all know that, you know, I mean, a rising proportion of UK discretionary expenditure is going on eating out and such the like. So, yeah, Green King.
He does mention Ashmore as well.
Emerging markets.
Yeah, obvious sort of play there.
Yeah. Okay, we've also got John Barron. John Barron's latest investment trust portfolio. John Barron is betting big on Europe. Lots of stuff in the personal finance section. I don't know if there is a personal finance podcast this week because Moira's on holiday, but we've got a great piece on currency hedging, which is very important if you want to tap into the returns on offer in countries like Japan or regions like Europe, where despite the fact that stock markets are doing well, your returns will be wiped out by the currency weakness there. And there's lots of ways to get around that by hedging. All the usual stuff, all the usual tips, not so many results this week, and all the usual wonderful columnists, Simon, Chris. And on that note, I will bid you farewell and see you again next week. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.